From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, on the first day of questioning by the Senate Judiciary Committee, Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett defined herself as an originalist along the lines of her mentor, the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, someone who would not deviate from the Constitution as originally written. But she also sought to differentiate herself somewhat from Scalia.
If I'm confirmed, you would not be getting Justice Scalia. You would be getting Justice Barrett.
Well, let's find out more about what that meant today from NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Robin.
And first, you know, there was a lot of, pontificating, shall we say, from the lawmakers on the panel around her. How did Judge Barrett come across this morning?
You know, for all the controversy from Democrats and Republicans and fighting about this nomination, I don't think any of them would argue that Judge Amy Coney Barrett is well qualified for the job. A professor at Notre Dame Law School for many years, a judge on the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court for the last 3 years, and in fact, at one point, Senator John Cornyn of Texas asked Judge Barrett to hold up any documents she had in front of her this morning that she was using to answer the questions. She held up a blank sheet of paper with a Senate stationery headed at the top of it. She was speaking off the cuff with no notes all day so far.
Yeah. Well, the chairman, Lindsey Graham, asked her how it felt to go through a grueling confirmation process. She said she was aware of caricatures of her life choices, particularly aspects of her Roman Catholic faith.
Look, I've made distinct choices. I've decided to pursue a career and have a large family. I have a multiracial family. Our faith is important to us. All of those things are true, but they are my choices. And in my personal interactions with people, I mean, I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them. And the same is true professionally.
What do you make of her response and also the different tactics both sides are taking? In the past, at least one member of this group has been accused of attacking her, saying she had dogma.
Yes, well, that was in 2017, of course, right? But today and now, since her unveiling at the Rose Garden by President Trump just a short while ago as his third pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett has sought to say and argue that she will judge based on the law, based on the meaning of the founders of the Constitution and the text on the page of a statute, and that her personal beliefs will not bleed into how she's going to rule in any number of hot-button issues. Democrats are really trying to push her on that, though, Robin, and they're getting a little frustrated because she's pretty good and cagey at not answering a lot of specific questions so far.
Well, for instance, have we learned any more today about how she would rule on the abortion rights law Roe v. Wade? Here's her answer on whether she'd strike down rulings supporting abortion rights.
If I express a view on a precedent one way or another, whether I say I love it or I hate it, it signals to litigants that I might tilt one way or another in a pending case.
She also quoted Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as she said, Ginsburg said, no hints, no previews, nor forecasts. But after that, the ranking Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, says it's distressing not to get a straight answer. You know, do they really expect one? What did you think about how she was pressed?
You know, it's difficult here because before she became a judge, Amy Coney Barrett had a record of making writings and speeches and other things, including signing an ad in 2006 that criticized the barbaric legacy of the landmark abortion rights ruling Roe v. Wade, and basically writing a lot that she believes human life begins at conception. And so when she's asked questions about whether she would vote to uphold or move away from Roe v. Wade if she gets on the Supreme Court, she's having a hard time dancing around those questions. She's basically arguing that she would follow the law, but a lot of Democratic senators are very dubious about what she might do with Roe v. Wade in terms of either overturning that precedent altogether, voting to overturn it altogether, or slowly chipping away at it in the 17 or more lawsuits around the country seeking to do that right now.
And just briefly, she also wouldn't say if she would recuse herself from any election cases involving President Trump if a decision reaches the Supreme Court, as it did 20 years ago in Bush v. Gore. How consequential? I mean, people listen to that very carefully, I imagine.
Absolutely. And for Democrats on the committee, they're arguing that the reputation of Judge Barrett is at stake and the legacy and legitimacy of the Supreme Court could be at stake, too. President Trump has made no secret he wants this nominee confirmed before the election because he doesn't want the court to vote, the short-handed court to vote 6-6 in deadlock on any election-related challenges. He wants his new justice to vote in his favor. But the nominee, Barrett, is basically saying that she will follow the law if she is confirmed and the regulations, but she will not commit to recusing.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thousands of people in Georgia showed up to the polls for early in-person voting yesterday. And soon voters in other states will also have the opportunity to cast their ballots in person. In light of President Trump's recent comments calling for supporters to watch voting locations to sniff out fraud, we wanted to get a better understanding of poll watching versus voter intimidation and what your rights are. And for that, we brought in Sarah Brannon, managing attorney of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. Brannon and I started our conversation by talking about how to spot the difference between a certified poll watcher versus someone who is not certified.
So in a polling place, the poll worker will check that they have certification before they let the person stay, sit down, hang out, watch what's going on. And a certified poll watcher requires that your name has been turned over to election authorities before election day and that you have an affiliation with a party or a ballot initiative that has an issue on the ballot.
Brannon says authorized poll watchers are inside of a polling location, and they must show their certification to a polling worker before they can enter. And outside, it's perfectly legal for regular citizens to watch what's happening if they're 50 to 75 feet away from an entrance and they aren't intimidating voters. Brannon lays out what that looks like.
Voter intimidation is illegal. So I can give you some examples. It's to aggressively questioning people about their qualifications to vote, making false representations that you are an election official or making false representations about voter requirements, physically blocking a polling place, taking pictures or photographs of people coming in and out or of their cars, writing down their license plates numbers, informing people that they have to speak English because you don't have to speak English to vote in America, you know, and blocking the door, yelling at people are things that have been found to be voter intimidation over the years.
So the question is, what can you do if you feel intimidated? Brannon says voters have a lot of options, but one thing you should not do is take on the same tactics as a person you feel is intimidating you.
You should not engage in somebody who's engaged in voter intimidation. You should try your best to ignore them, but you should note and what you have observed. So we don't recommend that voters take pictures or write things, you know, or write down people's license plate numbers or things like that. Since, as I said, the courts have found that to be intimidating and we don't want people to be engaging. But you can observe what's going on. So you, as a voter, if you see it in this circumstance, you can just, you know, take some mental notes in your head of what's going on, and then you should call and report it. And you can report it to the Election Protection Hotline, which is 1-866-R-VOTE if you observe it. The other thing to do is definitely to report it to your local election officials. Go into the polling place, report it to a poll worker that's there. Most state governments and most election officials have a mechanism in place to help address voter intimidation.
You know, this will be the first election since that 1982 consent decree, which was set in place because it was believed that the Republican National Committee was actually using tactics that resulted in voter suppression. How did this decree work, and what does it actually mean for this election?
I mean, I think it's important to note that in not every state, but many states in the country, it's illegal to have a firearm at a polling place, even if you have a license to carry. It was part of the consent decree from New Jersey that people were not allowed to come into polling places as poll watchers with firearms. So that was one of the different things in the consent decree. What the Republicans were doing, and which was then considered to be barred by the consent decree requirements, was this sort of aggressive undertaking about whether people were meeting the voting qualifications and presenting themselves in a circumstance that they were somehow formally associated with the state or local government to be doing verification of people's eligibility to vote and aggressively engaging with voters about whether they were or were not eligible to vote. And that is what the consent decree banned. One of the advantages of the consent decree was that the RNC needed to adhere to certain procedures and clear certain procedures beforehand related to their poll watching programs. And they don't need to do that this year. And so we want everyone to feel safe and we want everyone to vote. It's incredibly important that people vote. And as I said, most state governments and local governments are prepared to handle these things. But I think it is appropriate to be concerned as to whether poll watchers or people out in front of polling places will cross the line and venture into voter intimidation. And so we are keeping close watch also. We're observing. And if you have problems, we hope people will report them to the hotline.
That's Sarah Brannon, managing attorney of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project. Sarah, thank you so much.
Happy to talk to you today.
The new documentary, Driving While Black, has a surprise twist. We expect it to be all about current events, the disproportionate number of blacks stopped by white police officers for low-level or no offenses, what parents tell their children about in The Talk, about driving while black. But only the last few minutes of this wonderful documentary is devoted to that, although with devastating results, as we see video after video of these always humiliating, often tragic encounters. It's what we see up to them, though, that makes us understand that this is a natural outcome of over 100 years of just moving while black. Here's MIT history professor Craig Steven Wilder in the film.
For me, the term driving while black isn't just a slogan. It's not just part of our political rhetoric. It's not just something we say to remind ourselves of the persistence of racism in the United States. It's a very personal experience of remembering, in fact, the anxiety, the fear.
The film is called Driving While Black, Race, Space, and Mobility in America. It airs on PBS stations across the country tonight, based on the work of historian Gretchen Soren, who joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so much.
So you've written a book on this, also called Driving While Black. You approached filmmaker Rick Burns about making this into a documentary. What did you want people to know?
Well, I think, as I was working in the research for this project, I realized that this was really a story about mobility and about mobility denied. So we really had to go all the way back to the beginning and look at enslaved people coming to the New World and not being able to move about freely. And mobility is central to freedom. So when the automobile comes into existence in the 20th century and African Americans have more disposable income and are moving into the middle class, they want to get on the road because they can, because that freedom had been denied for generation after generation.
But it's still petrifying, as we'll hear. But I want to go back to what you were saying. No mobility on a slave ship, no choice there. As a slave, they needed papers to get around. And the first kind of slave-catching militias became our modern police forces. I mean, that's how they were born. So there's some DNA there. And then while blacks could move post-slavery, there were still terrible restrictions, the main one being fear.
There were so many places in the country where African Americans could not go. There were sundown towns. Those are towns that you had to be out of before sundown or something terrible would happen. There were angry mobs that you had to deal with. And everything, of course, north and south was segregated. And you didn't necessarily know the rules because the way segregation worked, there were different rules of etiquette in every single state. And in the South, while there were signs that told you colored only or whites only, in the North, segregation was by custom and tradition. So you just were expected to know where you were not welcome.
Yeah. And as we move through time, you know, there's buses, there's trains, but segregation there. And then come cars. But still with this fear. I mean, Americans all across the country, white Americans were jumping into cars to go see the USA and their Chevrolet. But for blacks, it was still packing everything because you couldn't stop.
So since you couldn't stop, African Americans really preferred to drive these really large cars, these really heavy cars. And the reason wasn't because of vanity. They wanted large cars because they had a large trunk. And in that trunk, you could carry everything that you needed. You might carry blankets and pillows because you couldn't stop at a hotel. You might carry all of the food that you needed for whatever the trip was because there were no restaurants that you could stop at. You might carry a can or two of gasoline because you didn't know if the gas station that you pulled into would sell you any gas. So you really had to carry a lot of stuff in your car just to make sure that you could get your family from point A to point B safely. And of course, you had to carry that large coffee can as a pee can. And I mean a can that your family could use as a toilet just in case you weren't allowed to use the bathroom at the local gas station.
This is an ancient history. This is 40s, 50s, 60s. And you have some memories of this?
Well, and you know, as I worked on this, I started to really understand my parents. So I'm the product of the Great Migration. My parents moved to New Jersey from North Carolina in 1948. Every summer, we would get in the car, the family Ford, and we would drive back to Fayetteville, North Carolina. But we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and drive in the dark because, you know, my father felt it was good to get an early start. Well, I learned as I did this research that most African Americans like to drive in the dark because when you're driving in the dark, it's harder to tell who's in the car. It's less likely that you're going to be stopped.
Yeah. And many of us know aspects of this who are not black and wouldn't have had that family history. But there was the film Green Book about black jazz pianist Don Shirley, who used this Negro motorist Green Book to help him find places to stay because there's so many ironies here. Yes, how fearful, how it makes your blood boil to think that there are families doing this. On the other hand, what sprung up around this were these places across the country compiled in this Green Book where black families knew they'd be welcome.
Yes.
This was all created by a mailman, Victor Hugo Green from New York City, who wanted it to travel to see relatives down south. He put together this guide, found a white publisher. A wonderful travel log and a wonderful travel world sprung up.
A huge network, a network of tourist homes and guest houses and hotels and motels and restaurants and little sandwich shops. And these were the places that were welcoming, the places that wanted African-American patronage. And also it had advertisements for gas stations. So you knew which places would accept you and where you could use the bathroom. Victor Green and his guide was not the only one. There were dozens and dozens of these guides. But this is how African Americans navigated across the country.
Yeah. Then a couple things happened. I'm going to trip through time here a bit. But you had the Civil Rights Act of 1964, of course, welcome. But in some ways, it hurt this world that you just described because white-owned businesses finally opened to black Americans. Also, the interstate road system is built in 1956, these huge freeways, which allowed blacks to travel faster and more freely on the huge freeways and not go down these little scary side roads, which also took them away from some of these resorts and black places of business. So much was lost there. But what stayed is that sense somewhere. I mean, do you feel it connected to the history you just described of your own parents? Do you feel that in your cell structure when you drive?
You know, it's funny. I was telling my husband the other day that whenever I see a police car, it just catches me up short. It terrifies me. And I think of so many African Americans going out on the road when they see a police car. We certainly don't hate the police. But the feeling that you don't want to encounter that one police person, police officer, male or female, that could be a racist, that's, I think, the current terror. Every person that worked on this, all of the scholars, had some story about being stopped by the police or having their child stopped by the police. It's quite terrifying.
Well, or even having to tell your child, chances are this could happen to you. Here's Pasadena City College professor Christopher West, who's just explained how devastating this is to have to tell your children the talk. Here he is.
I think it's really, really tough for the majority of Americans to begin to even understand the gut-wrenching horror that is driving in a racist society.
Parents today were children in the 50s and 60s and 70s, driving at night with their parents out of fear.
I remember during the unrest in Newark in the 1960s, I was in a car with my mom, and we were going home to the suburbs, and my mother had on her headlights, and we got stopped at a checkpoint, and a National Guardsman started screaming at her that she shouldn't have her headlights on. And I remember thinking, as I worked on this, that story came back to my mind, and you know, she didn't understand that she wasn't supposed to be driving with her headlights on. It was nighttime. But he had his gun leveled at us because he assumed that she was trying to blind him with her headlights, which couldn't have been further from the truth. So it really kind of frightens me because there's so many misunderstandings. You know, police will assume that someone who's African-American must be a drug dealer if you're driving a nice car, or he must be involved in some kind of criminal activity. We stereotype people.
And assumptions are made about police officers because
absolutely
it's life-saving. You want to be prepared for what has happened and might happen again, even though that's unfair in that direction as well.
Absolutely. It's totally unfair that we have stereotyped all of the police as if they are a monolithic group. And I know that there are so many police that are very upset about what they see happening and about their profession being maligned.
I tell you, Gretchen Soren, again, co-creator with Rick Burns of the new documentary Driving While Black, watching this will go a long way to helping people understand how we got here.
Thank you.
Gretchen's also the author of the book of the same name that the film was based on, and the director of the Cooperstown grad program of the State University of New York at Oneonta. Professor Soren, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And Driving While Black airs tonight on PBS stations. For more, go to hereandnow.org.
Last April, during the first wave of COVID-19, Italy was one of the worst hit European countries. Thousands of people were infected and the disease decimated many older Italian communities. The country is once again experiencing a surge of coronavirus cases, and now the government there is implementing new rules to slow the spread. The BBC's Mark Lowen is on Skype from Rome. And Mark, we've been hearing about surges throughout Europe. What are some of the reasons for this current surge in Italy?
I think that there's the feeling, Tanya, that Italy was perhaps behind the curve in terms of the pickup in infections. It was the one of, if not the last country in Europe to open schools, to reopen schools. And the weather dropped here, the climate dropped here later than in parts of Northern Europe. So there was a feeling when Italy was seeing fewer infections than, for example, France or Britain, there was the feeling that perhaps the worst was yet to come. And we are now seeing an increase in infections here to the level of the number of cases that there were back in April. And so they're taking measures to try to combat that.
Is anyone suggesting a new nationwide lockdown?
At the moment, they are not talking about that. They're talking about sort of targeted measures. So, for example, as of today, all indoor and outdoor parties, private parties, have been banned. At religious ceremonies, baptisms, weddings, etc., there is a cap on numbers of 30 people. Amateur sports, contact sports, for example, amateur football has been banned. Restaurants must now close at midnight, and there can only be table service after 9 p.m. to try to stop people from congregating on streets. So they're trying these targeted measures to avoid a national lockdown because, of course, Italy, like every other country that tried a national lockdown, saw the catastrophic economic impact of that. And so they're weighing up public health versus economic hit.
What about daily life right now in Italy? You mentioned last April, and what was striking to me about the devastation was that there were so many older communities that were completely decimated because of COVID-19.
Yeah, you'll remember, Tanya, that Italy was the first country in the West to be crushed by coronavirus when it first hit. It was the first country in the world to impose a national lockdown. And many countries, including, of course, the US, looked at what was happening in Italy as an omen, a very worrying omen of what was to come to the rest of the world. Now, it has emerged from that cloud. And I have to say, as I said, like a slower infection rate than we are seeing in other parts of Europe. And daily life at the moment is carrying on pretty normally. There is the obligation to wear masks outside as well as in restaurants and bars and cafes and the like. And the government has even suggested that you wear masks inside if you are mixing with people not from your household. And I think what happened really, Tanya, by being hit first, Italians were scared into a rather uncharacteristic widespread obedience to the government. And so mask wearing has been scrupulous really throughout this whole pandemic. And the government has been pretty clear on its messaging, and that's been widely followed. So the Prime Minister has a very high approval rating for how he's handled the pandemic. And at the moment, Italians seem to be following the rules. We'll have to see if that continues, if the rules and if the measures become more stringent.
That's the BBC's Mark Lowen in Rome. Mark, as always, thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Foodies, hold on to your toaster ovens. Wait, you don't have one? Well, our next guest says they're actually better than your big expensive ovens for things like browning dishes or toasting nuts. And speaking of nuts, if this whole cooking joyfully during a pandemic, including performing incantations over your own sour bread starter, is wearing thin, he also says you can make baguettes in your food processor with no kneading, or make a vegetable stew with a 20-ounce bag of frozen mixed vegetables. Who is this heretic? Well, none other than French cooking icon, 24-time James Beard award-winning chef, TV host, and author. Is there anything he can't do? Jacques Pepin. His new book is Quick and Simple. Chef Pepin, Jacques, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
You have written more than 30 cookbooks. What more could you possibly have left to say?
Well, I could probably write a book with 10,000 recipes just with chicken. If you go to South Africa or Turkey or West Africa, any place you go, there is people who do recipe with chicken. Also, the fact that, I'm turning 85, metabolism change. The same recipe that I did many years ago, I probably, like many young chefs, tend to add and to add and to add to the plate. And now as I'm getting older, I kind of take away. Mm-hmm. From the plate to be left with the essential.
Or you can tell us what to do with things, things are new, but also things that are old. I mean, I loved what to do with leftover, all those little pieces of cheese. It's a page titled Cheese Mishmash. And you can just take old pieces of cheese, put them through a processor with some white wine and garlic and spread them as a puree on crackers, or take the crumbles, combine them with sunflower seeds, cranberries, honey, lemon juice. Just that. Yeah. We'll change my cheese drawer.
Oh, no, absolutely. The point is that I have probably 30 recipes that I can do with leftover cheese.
Before it becomes a lab experiment in that cheese drawer. This book is about keeping it simple. You say it's okay to let someone else do some of your prep, meaning buy pre-washed greens, get canned foods as well. Which ones? Describe a perfect pantry.
Oh, yeah, my God, I have to go in my pantry. I have a lot of canned of beans and a lot of different tomato and some sardines, some anchovies, some tuna. There is nothing wrong with any of this.
I was so interested to see how many canned fish things you have, like canned mussels, canned smoked oysters. And I was thinking, that's interesting. And then here's this great recipe. A can of black beans, some smoked oysters, some garlic oil, sesame oil, red wine vinegar, blah, blah, Mix this whole thing up with some sour cream, and then you've got black bean hummus with smoked oysters.
See, I didn't even remember that one. Thanksgiving coming, for example. Now, of course, I'm used to pumpkin pie. I love it. And I do it in the French way, that is with a can of pumpkin, just plain without any seasoning, a cup of light cream in it, and some Swiss cheese, salt, pepper, a few eggs, and you do a beautiful gratin for Thanksgiving or stuff like this. You know.
Some of these are pretty sophisticated. You've got shrimp with cabbage and caviar, poached black cod with butter capers. But you also say make a French baguette in a food processor, a single bowl. Something about COVID has made Americans run to bake bread. But you can get real baguettes from this single bowl food processor procedure.
Of course, you know, and someone will make a baguette which is two or three time proof, which takes overnight, and it's probably better. But this is very good too. And talking about bread, one thing that you would never do, never throw out any bread. So, you know, I have bread left over. Like I did last night, actually. So I had bread left over. You run it under water, put it into the oven for 10 minutes, and it becomes very crisp and crunchy again. Or you use it in a little crouton or breadcrumb or whatever. I mean, I put my oven on, and it will take about 5, 6, 7 minutes for the oven to get to 425 degrees. During that time, I can take 2 cups of flour, some salt, water with it, and 1 or 2 teaspoons of baking powder, mix it, you know, to do an Irish soda bread. And it won't take you more than 3, 4, 5 minutes to stir it. It doesn't have to proof. You put it on your tray, your oven is not even at 425, and your bread is ready to go into the oven. It's very good, too.
Well, and, you know, for those who might say, oh, mais no, we can't do that. That's not French cooking. I remember, you know, Julia Child, the late wonderful friend of yours, you did a television show together, lived in New England. And I remember being over there taping a story, and we were so excited because lunchtime was coming, and we thought for sure we would have some grand meal. And she got out her bottle of mayonnaise and a can of tuna and made us a tuna sandwich. And you know, she said, don't make your own mayonnaise. Hellman's is the best.
Sure. And on the other hand, Julia, a recipe for baguette was like 12 pages. You know, so. Sometimes you can do it one way, sometimes you do it another way. But, you know, what's more important is to cook together with the family, with the kid, and to share the meal and to share a conversation. And, you know, I've been married 54 years. For over 54 years, we sit down every night. I cook, or sometimes my wife cooks, and we share a bottle of wine, sometimes 2 bottles of wine. And this is very much part of who we are, what our tradition is. You know, I have chicken cooking now. I just cooked some string beans, and I have some cheese and a big salad, and that's it. That's dinner.
One of the things I'm hearing you say is that, especially in this time when many people are forced to eat together in ways they hadn't, why not make it easier on yourself? You're okay with frozen pie crusts. They're in the refrigerator section. I almost don't want to tell people because they're usually sold out, but it's okay to use that.
Sure, but it depends what you do with it, too. A few days ago, my wife called me to tell me that, I don't know, a friend of us was stopping by for lunch. So, you know, I was just at the market. I pick up a rotisserie chicken, and I had a big Boston lettuce. I cut the chicken to put on top. I put some garlic, some onion or shallot, whatever I had, in a skillet sauté. Sprinkle that on top of my chicken with a bit of lemon juice, the juice of the chicken on top of my salad.
And voila. And you mentioned you're in your mid-80s now. What a career. Decades of teaching people, especially here in America, this brand new way for many of having more than your cod and your baked beans or, you know, chicken and potatoes, expanding our palates. Do you reflect on that, the influence you and others, you know, Julia Child, have had on how we eat?
Well, I don't really know the influence, but, you know, I can tell you that since the beginning of March, I have a Facebook. I don't do it. My daughter does my Facebook. And since then, I have done 160 shows of 2, 3 minutes for a simple recipe to show how to use that thing left over, another thing left over, or what I have in my freezer, or my refrigerator, or in the pantry. And for someone who has never cooked, if you do something very easy like this, it brings them into cooking and they become more confident and they will do it more. Another thing, too, is that very often I am considered maybe the quintessential French chef. I've been told I have an accent even. But The point is that you take one of my book and page 22, you find a black bean soup with banana and cilantro on top. At the next page, a thousand fried chicken, then a New England clam chowder. After over 60 years in America, I'm probably the quintessential American chef now.
Well, let me ask a couple quick questions. Best way to do scallops? I see in your recipe 2 tablespoons of water and you don't turn them?
Yeah, absolutely. You just have a little bit of water to give you the moisture to poach it very briefly and you finish it up. There is many fish that I do this way. For example, salmon. I was showing that to my granddaughter the other day. I put it in a cold skillet, skin side down, without any fat or anything like that. A bit of salt, pepper on top. And I put it on full blast with a lid on top. And it will take about 5-6 minutes to cook. And I never turn the salmon because I have a lid on top of it. And it gives me enough steam from outside the salmon to cook the top. And the skin end up being cooked very crisp and all that. In fact, I'm doing the same thing tonight for dinner. I have 2 thigh of chicken. You put it on the table, skin side down, and then you cut along the central bone on each side just to expose the bone a little bit so it cooks faster. Then after I put salt, pepper, again, without any fat, I put that into my non-stick pan with a lid, and I will cook that chicken thigh probably 25 minutes without turning it. Then I take it out. Maybe I put a bit of garlic in the pan to whatever. You know, it's a simple way to cooking. And, you know, that's what you have to tell people.
So many great tips. It's just always so lovely to speak with you. The name of the new cookbook, Quick and Simple, Jacques Pepin. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And recipes, herenow.org.
In an attempt to retake the Senate, Democrats are pushing to win votes, including in red states like Alaska. Outside groups are flooding the state with money in support of Republican Senator Dan Sullivan and his Democratic-backed independent challenger, Dr. Al Gross. And that's where we turn for this week's Here and Now Senate Tracker, looking at Senate races nationwide. Liz Ruskin is Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Liz, welcome.
Thank you, Tanya.
Liz, let's look at the candidates, starting with Dan Sullivan, who posted this video online recently.
Hey, Alaska. In 2014, with the support of so many of you, we won a U.S. Senate seat. National Democrats are still mad about that and want to flip our state and the Senate blue. We cannot allow that to happen. You know what their agenda is. Anti-resource development and anti-oil and gas development in our state. Anti-Second Amendment. Anti-military. They will.
So we hear him making a lot of claims there about Democrats and trying to tie his opponent to Democrats nationally. What has Sullivan's record been like and what is he running on?
He has been mostly a party line voter in the Senate. Like a lot of Republicans, he's mostly avoided criticizing President Trump. And, you know, where Alaska's other senator, Lisa Murkowski, is well known for, you know, at least sometimes bucking her party, Sullivan is just, he's not that. One of the things that serves him well is his military experience. He's still a colonel in the Marine Reserves, and he's known for taking every opportunity on the Armed Services Committee to talk up Alaska's strategic importance and the need to build up military assets in Alaska. Alaska is a big military state with a lot of veterans, so it plays pretty well up there.
Let's take a look at Sullivan's opponent, Dr. Al Gross, an independent former orthopedic surgeon. Here's a recent ad.
I left my practice because it wasn't right how insurance companies ripped off Alaskans. I went to study public health policy instead. We can jumpstart our economy by lowering Alaskan healthcare costs so more businesses move here.
I approve this message because Dan Sullivan's voted over and over to kill affordable healthcare. We need a new senator.
Okay, so Dr. Gross is referring there to Sullivan's votes against the Affordable Care Act. Senator Sullivan has said he wants a replacement that also protects coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. But what more can you tell us about Dr. Gross? Because he's actually an independent.
Yeah, he's a nonpartisan who won the Democratic nomination. That's an odd deal that the Alaska Democratic Party allows. It doesn't require its candidates to be Democrats themselves. So, yeah, he's a commercial fisherman from Southeast Alaska. He became an orthopedic surgeon, as he said. Then he got a master's in public health. He's a first-time candidate. We hear, I think, two main messages from his campaign. One is that he's a real Alaskan and that he's not a liberal. Gross says he's for oil development in the Arctic Refuge, for the Second Amendment, and his campaign is making a lot out of an incident where he killed a bear in self-defense. That was years ago, but there's an ad with a jingle about that bear that Alaskans, even those who support Gross, they're saying it's stuck in their head and driving them to the brink.
Oh, that's really interesting. There's also been a controversy around a mining project that's been haunting Sullivan's campaign. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the Pebble Mine. Pebble is a proposed gold mine that would be upstream from Bristol Bay. That's the home of the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. So this proposed mine is hugely unpopular with a significant segment of Alaska voters. And this fall, an environmental group secretly recorded mine executives bragging that they had Sullivan right where they want him, in a corner, keeping his mouth shut, quiet in a corner. And that's just not a good look for a U.S. senator.
We mentioned that there's been an influx of money coming into this race in recent weeks. What's been happening?
Yeah, I think that early on, Sullivan was thought to have it sewn up, so the big money stayed out. And now that it looks closer, the Gross campaign reported raking in $9.1 million for the third quarter, and that is a huge state record. In just the last few days, the independent expenditure groups are starting to pour money into the race also. Most of it is aimed at unseating the Republican, Sullivan.
What do the polls say right now?
Polls suggest, oddly enough, that it might be close. And, you know, Alaska is said to not be an easy place to poll. So we don't have a lot of polls, and there are a lot of doubters about that. But there have been a few polls, a couple of polls that have shown that it is close.
Liz Ruskin is Washington correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.